I was in the airport this past week, flew up to Asheville, North Carolina, and know the leaves are only barely starting to turn, but it was nice to sit outside in the 60-degree weather and try to absorb as much of that coolth as possible. But when I was cruising through the airport on my way back, I saw the cover of Time magazine, and it said, "What to Eat Now, Uncovering the Myths About Food," and it was by Dr. Oz. And Dr. Oz has become one of the rock stars in the everybody's favorite doctor nutritionist category, supplanting Andy Weil as, or Weil, if you will, as everybody's favorite holistic doctor. And so I picked up this copy of Time magazine and I read it, and I really have to give every bit of credit for this show to Dr. Oz, because I'm going to share with you some of his ideas for those of you that don't read Time magazine, because he brings forward some really very important principles. For those of you that don't know, don't watch daytime TV, because I sure don't watch Dr. Oz's TV show, and, you know, when he was on Oprah or the other things that he's been on, you know, he is a practicing cardiologist. And so when a heart surgeon has been inside the body and has seen, you know, one patient with the goo found in their blood vessels and then the next patient without the goo found in their blood vessels, and you wonder what the difference is, you know, Dr. Oz is a surgeon, and so he tries to heal with steel, as the surgeons say. And you know, surgeons are essentially have one measuring tool. A good day's work, a life is saved, and a bad day's work, the patient dies. There's no room for anything but that dividing line. And so for those docs that heal with steel, they often don't pay much attention, actually, to what gets a patient in that trouble. But what Dr. Oz realized very quickly was that the reason that they were different was the food that they ate. You know, our history as a species is such that we were always searching for food. That's why they called us hunter-gatherers. We were constantly on the prowl. You know, one of the reasons your cortisol levels, that hormone that your adrenal glands make, is highest at 8 o'clock in the morning. It starts to rise about 4 a.m. and just keeps on going up until about 8 o'clock in the morning. And then it should fall gracefully over the course of the day, so by 10 o'clock at night, you're ready to go to sleep. Well, the reason that cortisol is highest first thing in the morning is we used to have to get up and hunt. Every day it would have been a challenge to see where our next meal was coming from. And that went on for tens of thousands of years. So when we look at the history of food hunting, we realize that the bounty of calories that we have available today, and it would be easy to say an excess bounty of calories, is very different from what our history was through all of the tens of thousands of years prior to the 20th century. Because the availability or the scarceness of food was literally what ran civilizations up until about 10 or 12,000 years ago, when we began to cultivate plants as opposed to being hunter-gatherers. You know, we can look at the issue with famine around the world, and certainly it continues to exist. And famine fundamentally exists politically at this point. There's enough food on the planet to feed every single one of the 7 billion people that are here, but politics keeps food from getting to certain places. And of course, as population continues to grow, and there really is only one task at hand, which is to slow the growth of the population, otherwise we'll eat everything that's here and you know, be left with a bare planet and a whole lot of dead bodies. But the nature of looking at this food scarcity, it's just like the last 100 or even 200 years that we haven't really had that. Finally, we don't have food scarcity. Finally, we actually have an abundance of food, and you would think that what it would do would be to produce the healthiest generation in history. But in fact, It's doing exactly the opposite. It's creating a steady decline in health. You know, we are seeing epidemics of diabetes, of heart disease, of obesity. You know, Dr. Oz made a statement in this article that the problem isn't that people don't want to eat and be well. He says that no one's ever been wheeled into the operating room that's happy to be there. And the problem isn't that they don't know the wisdom of a healthy diet. More often than you think, the problem is that a lot of folks don't know what a healthy diet looks like. And why should they, since it's constantly changing? You know, one of the challenges to me as a professional nutritionist is the fact that Monday eggs were good for you and Tuesday eggs would kill you and Wednesday eggs were good for you again. And so people got confused. You know, we got to the point that we were switching around what was healthy and what wasn't healthy. I grew up with the idea that red meat was a good thing, but too much pasta was bad. And then all of a sudden, pasta was great and red meat was bad. And that all lasted until the Atkins craze came along, and then it reversed again. Then we lived through the fat-free diet, the Mediterranean diet, the South Beach diet, the grapefruit diet, the cabbage soup diet, the banana diet. I mean, I always loved the joke about the drinking woman's diet. You're still fat, you don't care. The individuals who think that they can drink their way to health with red wine or chomp their way to health with chocolate, well, it turns out that they're all wrong. Every single truth has got a little bit of myth attached to it. But we know more about food and its effect on the body than we ever did before. And we actually are settling into something that is good wisdom and not gimmickry. You know, in coincidence with this particular set of information came a release that happened just this weekend that showed that the Weight Watchers diet was the single most successful diet in having people keep weight off. That by the end of one calendar year, the half of the people that were in the Weight Watchers program lost just slightly less than 12 pounds, or about a pound a month, compared to the people that were supervised by a doctor who lost less than half that weight, about 7 pounds in a year. And so Weight Watchers did a pretty provocative study because there were 772 people in this study, and 61% of the participants assigned to the commercial program completed it, and 51% assigned to the doctor's program finished it. But that I misquoted earlier. I said they lost 6 or 7 pounds. What's true is for those who completed the full 12 months, the average weight loss was 14.7 pounds on Weight Watchers versus 7.3 pounds from the group given only doctor's care. The reason that I mention that is, you know, Weight Watchers is one of the organizations that's never taken a category out. You know, never saying don't eat meat or don't eat fruit or don't eat grain. What they've tried to do is teach us how to eat well. And this kind of weight loss is the kind of weight loss that sticks. And by sticks, I mean that the weight stays off. You know, I still get people that come into my practice that think that they're going to lose, you know, 10 pounds the first month and 8 pounds the second month and 6 pounds the third month. And while it's occasionally true, the body recalibrates itself pretty frequently. And so having steady weight loss that's a pound every week actually is not terribly common. And so some individuals would say, oh, losing 14.7 pounds in 12 months, you know, that doesn't seem like a lot. Oh, it is a lot, I guarantee you. Because you can't lose 10 until you lose 5, and you can't lose 20 until you lose 10. So one of the points that Dr. Oz made in this article is that people are confused. They don't know what a healthy diet is. And then you add to that the dilemma of the number of neighborhoods that are around that don't have any place that you can get fresh fruits and vegetables. I've spoken before about a class that I did at a high school in Tampa last year in the Healthy Tampa promotion. And at that particular event, I'm sorry I can't tell you the name of the high school right now, but if you dropped a plumb bob in the middle of the high school and you drew a circle 1 mile around, there was not a single grocery store. There was no place that you could go to get fresh fruits and vegetables, and yet there was a dozen fast food restaurants. So if you really want to get healthy, then forget about diet soda and low-fat foods. You know, I've said for a long time, we need to eat what occurs in nature. Potatoes occur in nature. Pringles don't. Chickens occur in nature. Chicken nuggets don't. So Dr. Oz and I together are going to endorse things like eggs and whole milk and salt and fat and nuts and wine and chocolate and coffee. Yeah, it's true. You know, the conventional wisdom has always been, oh, eggs are going to raise your cholesterol. We know that isn't true. We know that dietary cholesterol really may not affect blood cholesterol as much as what was once thought. You know, the only fat that we know that is absolutely trouble is trans fat. And, you know, the government did us an injustice, bowed to the effects of industry. Gee, like that's something new. And they allowed that if a product only had a half of a milligram of trans fats in it, they didn't even have to put it on the label. So if you're eating baked goods, crackers and things like that, cookies, then you're probably getting some trans fats in your diet. And those are hydrogenated and partially hydrogenated oils. So getting back to eggs, even the most conservative health organizations recommend that we eat one egg with a yolk every day. Because you've heard it before on No Nonsense Nutrition, there is a fat that's in an egg yolk called phosphatidylcholine that we just do not have in the rest of the American diet. It's fundamentally only in organ meats like brains and livers and kidneys, and those are not common in our cuisine. And so if you want to get phosphatidylcholine to protect the sheaths of your nerves and to protect your brain, because it's a big part of the weight of your brain, we've talked before on No Nonsense Nutrition that you're a fathead and I'm a fathead. They're not all in Washington, although there is a disproportionate number of them in Washington. When we begin to look at the nature of eggs in the diet, I've got to give two thumbs up to at least 7 eggs a week. And, you know, we talked about the multiple sclerosis support group earlier. People that have MS have damage to the sheath of their nerves that's called the myelin sheath. This is the same sheath that gets damaged when people have neuropathy, whether that neuropathy is caused by a drug or that neuropathy is caused by diabetes. The phosphatidylcholine, that special fat that's in egg yolks, helps to rebuild that nerve sheath. So it's even more critical for people who have MS, for people who have nerve sheath problems, or for people who have a diagnosis of brain atrophy. You know, you don't ever want to put atrophy and brain in the same sentence. Well, every single case that I've seen, the person is on a low-fat diet and on a cholesterol-lowering drug. And if you don't get enough fat in your diet, your body will eat your brain. No, this isn't the Halloween show, but it's true. Your body will eat your brain because your brain is the biggest reserve. It has the fat. You'd love it if it just ate your belly, but in fact, it doesn't do that. You know, fats have gotten beat up more than any other category. They treat it like it's a four-letter word. And yet we found out that even things like coconut oil, which we used to think were big trouble, actually have a lot of benefits. Coconut oil technically is a saturated fat, but coconut oil happens to have something called MCTs, medium chain triglycerides, which are fuel that gets used directly by your brain and by your heart. We used to think the brain only used glucose. Now we know that the brain uses other fuels as well. But there's no question that the monounsaturated fat like olive oil is the best in terms of lowering the bad cholesterol, the LDL, raising the good cholesterol, the HDL, and reducing the risk of hardening of the arteries and heart disease. That's the reason that I say fish oil is the second most important supplement to take after your multivitamin, because we need those kinds of good fats. So keep the eggs in your diet. You know, we look at things like whole milk and what a campaign there's been against whole milk. And yet, if you don't have some fat in the dairy product, whether it's the yogurt, the cottage cheese, or the milk, you can't transport the fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin K. So skim milk isn't really a very good idea. Now, it's important for us to understand that there is a limit in terms of amount. I mean, as soon as somebody drinks 2 8-ounce glasses of whole milk and, you know, gets all of that liquid fat in there, the nature of the calories is going to outweigh the health benefits. But if you're putting milk in your coffee and milk on your cereal and, you know, that's all you're getting here, I'm still going to endorse whole milk or at least 2%. Whole milk is 4%, by the way. Not 1% and not no fat. Milk helps to control weight because the calcium binds with the fat in the food digesting in your gut, so you absorb a little bit less of the fat. There have been studies that show no significant difference among skim, low-fat, and whole milk when it comes to weight control. But when you take out all the fat, you're left with too high a concentration of natural sugar. And so drinking that milk is like candy. So put whole milk back on the list of good things that we can eat. We know that salt is trouble for about 10% of the American population, and especially trouble for the African American population. They are particularly sensitive to salt. And so one of the reasons that the African American population has higher risk of heart disease, higher risk of stroke, is because of their salt sensitivity. The only way that you can be sure whether you're salt sensitive or not is to check your blood pressure after you consume salt and compare it when you've been relatively salt free. But even if your numbers stay in a healthy range, I don't want you going crazy with a salt shaker, because we know now that salt actually hardens the walls of the arteries. And I'm not talking about atherosclerotic plaque being deposited. I'm talking about the elasticity of the arteries. You know, our arteries should be really flexible, because with every heartbeat, they contract and expand and contract and expand. You know, when your heart is beating, when it's pumping, that's the downstroke. You've got a lot of pressure going through the vessels. But when the heart is filling, the pressure drops. And so at the point that the heart is resting in between beats or filling again, those blood vessels have to crimp just a little bit, constrict just a little bit to keep your pressure up. Otherwise, your pressure would go 120, 120. You know, you wouldn't be able to maintain consciousness. So that flexibility of the arterial wall, the flexibility of the blood vessel wall, is related to how much salt you get in your diet. And 85% of all the salt we get is in processed food. It's not in the salt shaker. It's in the salad dressing. It's in the sauce. It's, you know, in the ketchup and the mustard and the, you know, things that we put on top. It's in the can of soup. But what's true is that if you are hypertensive, meaning your blood pressure is consistently higher than 140 on the top number and higher than 90 on the bottom number, then you're going to benefit from reducing your salt intake. You know, that simple step of getting your salt down to 1,500 milligrams or less translates to an average of 5 extra years of life for a typical 55-year-old person. 5 years of life from putting the salt shaker down and not eating high-salt foods. That's a big deal. 5 years. So after we've had our eggs and whole milk and we put a little salt on our eggs and we've had the good fats, we're not going to forget nuts, wine, chocolate, and coffee. Nuts. And I don't mean honey-crusted cinnamon bomb nuts. I don't mean toffee-colored covered nuts. I'm just talking about nuts. So when you have a handful of almonds or cashews or walnuts, even peanuts. But I always remind you, don't grind that peanut butter yourself at the grocery store, even though it looks like you're at Grandma's General Store. Those peanuts that are sitting in the bin are usually nasty with mold. Buy your peanut butter in a jar. But back to nuts, a handful every day. Great snack at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's something I almost always finish the day with, or I have as soon as I get home from work, because that way I don't snack while I'm making dinner. Nuts give us very, very important minerals. You know, walnuts are especially beneficial because they're high in omega-3 fatty acids. But almonds give us cobalt, and Brazil nuts give us selenium. So there are certain nutrients that get concentrated in nuts because the root system is so deep. When you eat a piece of lettuce, the root system on lettuce is about 2 to 3 inches. It can't draw things from deep in the soil, but the root system on a Brazil nut tree is about 30 feet deep into the earth. So it can draw minerals that have been taken out of the upper part of the soil by repeated industrial farming. Handful of nuts, and that's a closed handful, by the way. So even though they're high in unsaturated fats and in calories, they can lower bad cholesterol, but they sure do help curb hunger. Chocolate is another source of antioxidants, and there's no question that the darker the chocolate, the better the antioxidants. So when you're drinking, eating milk chocolate, you've essentially watered down, or in this case, milked down. The adulteration with milk reduces the concentration of the beneficial flavonoids that are in there. So how about chocolate-covered almonds? We could kill two birds with one stone, as it were. So chocolate is a good source of antioxidants. And we know that those flavonoids, the very thing that gives cocoa beans their pungent taste, is where the benefit is. I have a client right now, and we were wanting to cut calories, but she told me right away that she was a chocoholic, and I suggested she just take her plain yogurt, organic yogurt, of course, and stir in plain cocoa powder into the yogurt, and add a little chocolate-flavored stevia. You know, stevia is the non-nutritive sweetener that is a natural sweetener. Unlike aspartame or sucralose or some of the other chemical minimum calorie sweeteners, stevia comes to us from the plant. And so chocolate-flavored stevia, yum, 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 a couple of drops into the yogurt, and you've sweetened it and given it a chocolate taste, and then throw a little cocoa powder on top of it, and she just made chocolate pudding out of that low-fat yogurt. And so it was a wonderful way for her to assuage her tremendous desire for chocolate on a daily basis and yet maintain a low-calorie profile. Having that glass of wine with those chocolate-flavored nuts. Actually, chocolate and red wine does just really go beautifully together. We know, once again, there are benefits in the wine, most notably resveratrol, which is an antioxidant that's found in grape skins. Resveratrol not only reduces the impact of bad cholesterol, the animal studies show that it reduces both obesity and diabetes. But there's only about 1 milligram of resveratrol in red wine. So, you know, you'd have to drink 27 bottles of red wine today and 27 bottles of red wine tomorrow and keep on going and keep on going. So I think the resveratrol needs to come in as a supplement as opposed to getting it with red wine. Even 2 ounces of red wine every day can benefit good cholesterol. It can protect the arteries against cholesterol-related damage. There are benefits to very small amounts of alcohol taken on a daily basis. Now remember, I can't endorse alcohol just because of how much pain it's caused people and families in our community and our nation. But at the same time, I can't deny the actual health benefits that come as a result of getting in a little bit of red wine every day. That blood thinning effect is good for your brain. And the last thing in Dr. Oz's list is coffee. Coffee, 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 coffee. For those of you that love your coffee, you know that too much coffee can make some people jittery. But there are individuals out there that have what's known as a really good phase one complement, phase one liver enzymes. You've got these bunch of enzymes called P450s, cytochrome P450s. And these enzymes are what help your body detoxify things. And caffeine is what's called a first pass compound, meaning these phase one enzymes are what get the caffeine out of the body. Well, some people don't have good phase one enzymes to clear caffeine, so they could drink a half a cup of coffee at 8 o'clock in the morning and still be buzzing at 11 o'clock at night. Other people, and I can remember my dad drinking a full mug of coffee at 10:45 and going to bed at 11 o'clock and being asleep at 11:05. So some people, the caffeine does not affect their sleep at all, never makes them jittery. But what we know for sure is that there are benefits to coffee. It reduces the risk of Parkinson's disease, it reduces the risk of pancreatic cancer, and it reduces the risk of diabetes. So the key is how much is too much. And that's the same with all of these things. You know, if you had more than 2 servings of whole milk dairy products per day, it's too much. If you have more than 1 ounce of dark chocolate a few times a week, it's too much. If you have more than 2 glasses of red wine every night, it's too much. Not only can it lead to an increase in weight, but as Dr. Oz says, it can lead to an increase in court appearances. Too much coffee can give you the shakes. Too much red meat, and 18 ounces is the current model, can not only contribute to weight gain, but it contributes to colon cancer. So when we look at these foods that we put a skull and crossbones on before, we find out that we can have them in the diet. You know, if we look at all the weight loss crazes that have come and gone over time in the American diet, I call it the diet du jour, because every day there's a new book on the market that, you know, will tell you that this is the miracle that's going to enable you to flatten your belly or lose that, you know, tire. Probably the single most dangerous thing, and I'm going to agree with Dr. Oz on this, is the label that said fat-free. Those two little words essentially gave people permission to indulge in whatever they want. And I can remember when the Snackwell crackers or cookies came out. There was a fudge Snackwell cookie, and it said fat-free on it. And it was easy to think, well, you know, one package isn't so much. So manufacturers really looked to cash in on people that were afraid of fat. And so because they lost so much taste, you know, fat is what holds the deep, delicious taste. To quote Anne-Marie Colbin, the famous author of Food and Healing, fat is what makes things deeply yummy. So when you strip the natural fats out of products, you had to compensate. And you did that with more salt, more sugar, and more thickener. And so as people ate more and more of the fat-free goodies, they got extra high doses of sodium, sugar, and thickener. But they didn't have either the filling effect that fat creates, because it gives us a sense of satisfaction and it slows the emptying time of our stomach, so it lets us feel full longer. So what it does is it makes us have a tendency to eat more. We know that diets that dramatically restrict our food choices, that take out an entire category, whether we take out all the grain or take out all the fruit or whatever it is, makes us crave whatever's not in there. Plus, you haven't learned how to eat better. You're just going on a special diet until you lose those pounds, and then you go back to eating the way you ate before that got you in trouble in the first place. I can remember reading the information about the cabbage soup or the grapefruit diet promising that you could lose 10 pounds in a week. Your liver could not process 10 pounds of fat in a week if you duct tape your mouth shut. It can't happen. Your liver can't process that much fat, because in order for fat to be burned as fuel, you have to change the fat into what's called a phospholipid. You have to add a phosphorus molecule to the fat for it to burn. I mean, think about a match. You light a match because it's got phosphorus on the end. The body lights a fat or burns a fat because it's got phosphorus on it. So when we realize that these promises are extreme, and they're just that, they're promises, and but you know, if you've gained weight, you're looking for a promise. You're looking for somebody to tell you that these foods burn more calories than they actually give you. You know, the Atkins diet has probably caused as much damage to kidneys as anything I've ever seen in my practice. Lots of meat and very few carbohydrates. And remember, a carbohydrate is not bread and pasta and rice and potatoes and birthday cake. A carbohydrate is anything that grows out of the ground. It doesn't matter if it's a fruit or a vegetable, a grain or a bean, a nut or a seed. If it grew out of the ground, it's a carb. And so Atkins diet kept trimming down the carbs and increasing the protein and essentially, you know, gave you no limit to the amount of protein that you could eat. Now, the new generation of the Atkins diet does add some more vegetables to it and still, you know, restricts the pasta, bread, and fruits. But there's no question that people lose weight on it. But I'm still waiting to meet the person. And if there's somebody out there in listener land who went on the Atkins diet and lost 20 pounds or more and kept it off for 2 years, I would love to hear your story. Because I have never yet met anybody who got it off and kept it off using that program. I've seen lots of stories of people who got it off, but not individuals who kept it off. You know, when we got into this low-carb, no-carb game, a lot of us wept. We wept at the loss of the croissant. We left at the loss of the cookie. But what's true is that when people meet their goal, they go right back to those things that they miss the most. You know, South Beach made the Atkins diet a little bit more palatable because it added more fruits and vegetables. And now we've come into this thing called the Paleo diet, because it postulates that, you know, our genes come from the Paleolithic period, which ended about 10,000 years ago. And so we were genetically designed to eat what was available then. There's a lot of logic in that. The Paleo diet focuses on lean meat and fish and fresh fruit, non-starchy vegetables. It takes out all the dairy products, takes out all the grains, takes out all the beans, because they didn't show up in our diet until 10 or 12,000 years ago. It wasn't until we began to, as they say, civilize, I question the use of that word, that we stayed in one place. Because see, if you're going to be a grain eater, you had to live in one place, and you had to put the grain in the ground, and you had to, you know, grow it, you had to protect it from the animals, you had to harvest it, you had to store it, you had to grind it, you had to make it into something. And so that required that you stay in one place and cultivate a village as well as the grain. When you were hunter-gatherers, that wasn't the case. You didn't stay in one place. You kept moving from place to place. So you couldn't grow food. So the Paleo diet is based on the idea that, you know, since those things were not available then, they were not in the diet, we shouldn't have them. But I got to tell you, the average longevity in those days was between 30 and 40 years old. So I don't know that we can equate that to not having dairy, grains, or beans in the diet. But I don't want to go back to a time where the average longevity was 30 to 40 years old. I do know that the Paleo diet can lower the risk of cardiovascular disease. And the thing that I like the most about the paleo diet is that we do exactly what I've always advised, eat what occurs in nature. When you look at your plate, it should be something your grandmother would recognize. When you look at your plate, it should look like what occurs in nature. I had my usual Monday morning bowl of fruit with yogurt on it. You've heard my diet enough times. A lot of variety in there today. I had papaya and fig and peach and carambola together with my yogurt. It was delicious. So the nature of that variety is going to change for me according to the season. You know, the pitted fruits are almost gone. The cherries, the peaches, the plums, apricots are already gone. The few nectarines left, a few peaches left, but, you know, pretty much in September, they're on the wane. They've been in cold storage, and when you get them home, if you don't eat them within 48 hours, they'll just turn into a brown pile of mush. Now we're moving into apples, pears, and grapes. It's that time of the year. And so the mangoes will go away, the other pitted fruits will go away, and we'll move into apples and pears and grapes, and of course the tropical fruits that we have the liberty of having all year long, like pineapple and papaya. But the fundamental thing is that when we're on the paleo diet, we're eating things that occur in nature. You know, they would have eaten eggs because it would have been easy to snark them out of a bird's nest. They would have eaten the seafood that was available near the shore, the shellfish and the small fishes. I was out at Siesta Key yesterday and I happily saw lots of fish in the water. So you would have been able to net and catch those fishes. You might have been eating small mammals, things that were easy to catch, again, like birds and rabbits. But you wouldn't have had grain, you wouldn't have had beans, you wouldn't have had dairy products. So there's something to be said for the paleo diet, but once again, what we have to separate is fadism from practicality. Our goal is still to reduce cancer and heart disease. You know, those are the biggest killers that we have in America. 75% of our deaths are cancer and heart disease. And the new report indicates that cancers are up 20% around the world in the last decade. We know in part that is due to the amount of toxins that we're exposed to. But in reading this article that Dr. Oz put together, he made another quote that I'd offer. I'd rather follow a diet that sees me lucid and active enough to play with my grandchildren than one in which I die young but look great. Says it all, doesn't it? Now, you want to remember that the perfect diet for a 12-year-old in his prime growth spurt years is not the same thing that's good for his father. You know, the nutrients that a breastfeeding woman in her 20s needs is very different from a postmenopausal 70-year-old. So accepting these absolute blanket statements about what people need and extrapolating that across the board to the entire population is really naive. Now, we know as a result of looking at heart surgeries, and again, Dr. Oz is a practicing heart surgeon, 5,000 heart surgeries under his knife, and so he still is going to recommend a diet low in saturated and trans fat to prevent the buildup of arterial plaque. So that says stop at 18 ounces of red meat a week and make sure that when you're eating red meat, the cut is round or loin. I talk about this repeatedly on No Nonsense Nutrition. Sirloin, tenderloin. When we choose round or loin, top round, bottom round, eye round, in the cut, we're getting the lowest amount of saturated fat possible. Now, we know there's a genetic risk factor that's involved as well. You know, one person can spend decades eating butter and baked goods and bacon and not have any problems with their arteries. The next person can be eating that and have tons of problems. Generally speaking, it equates back to how much fruits and vegetables the person has in their diet. those genes, that particular suite of genes that has to do with the synthesis and the utilization of cholesterol, changes from person to person. So some people can be sensitive genetically to these fats and really need to eat an incredibly low-fat diet, and other people don't. Now, gene testing gets cheaper and cheaper. You know, when I first started in practice here in Sarasota 23 and a half years ago, there was only two gene tests that were available, and they were both $1,000. Now I can test 35 genes for $500 and find out who has high risk. Now, these studies, these gene studies, are not always directly related to a clinical application, simply because we're still at the grade school level of understanding them. But what we can find is which people are way more sensitive to inflammation than other people are. We can have a gene defect in something called IL-1, IL-6, IL-10, or interleukin 1, 6, and 10. So that one person, when they get a splinter in their finger, they get it out, it's no big deal. Somebody else gets a splinter in their finger and it all blows up and turns red and gets tender and gets an infection. You know, why does one person go from 0 to 60 in inflammation right away and another person doesn't? We only know a piece of that. So we're not denying that genes have a factor in play, but I guarantee you that there is no gene that makes it a good idea to eat French fries. There is no gene that makes it a good idea to eat lousy hamburgers. There is no gene that makes it a good idea to live on sugar. When we pull healthy foods out of the diet and replace them with junk, we're going to create inflammation. And inflammation is the command that tells cholesterol to lay down and become plaque. So, you know, when I see fatty things, fatty things, not F-A-T-T-Y, fatty things. When I see fatty things like a gluten-free diet, I have clients that come in, they go, oh, I'm gluten-free. Well, I think gluten-free is critical for people that have celiac disease and critical for people who have non-celiac gluten sensitivity. But a gluten-free diet is not appropriate for everyone, or not necessary, I should say, for everyone. I see individuals that come into my practice all the time and they say, oh, I have to use lactaid milk because I have lactose intolerance. And in fact, it turns out that they're actually sensitive to dairy products in general. It isn't just the lactose. So there are places where food sensitivity testing really makes a huge difference in personalizing your eating plan. The really hard truth is it's work in terms of trying to eat healthy. In a society that advertises 10,000 commercials a year that children see to encourage them to eat a bowl of sugar bombs, to encourage them to have the things that are most associated with weight gain. You know, the New England Journal of Medicine put out a landmark study this summer. And what they compared was not how many calories people eat, but what kind of calories. And they adjusted it for age and baseline body mass index and lifestyle factors and exercise and sleep. And it was done on 120,000 people. But people who ate French fries, potato chips, sugary drinks, meats, sweets, and white flour grain were the people that were most likely to gain weight over 4 years. And the people that were the most likely to lose weight over 4 years were regular eaters of yogurt, nuts, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. When we look at a calorie-rich diet, it's not always a nutrient-rich diet. And so what's true is that when you eat good calories, it keeps you from eating the wrong kind of calories later. I didn't talk about exercising, but you know that's part of the equation for health. But I do want to give a special shout out to Dr. Oz and this week's Time Magazine, because I think that this article, What Do We Eat Now?, gives us some good ideas. And even though Dr. Oz did not endorse my favorites, cruciferous vegetables, onions and garlic and all of that allium family, I have to say I thought it was really well done. So kudos to Dr. Oz and the work that he's doing to bring people to their senses as far as food. And you know, if you want to eat healthier, you can start today. You can start with your lunch. You know, instead of having a sandwich, how about a salad? Instead of having chips on the side, how about some coleslaw? You know, little changes ultimately add up to big differences. And it's one meal at a time. You know, the first time I heard the term that your fork was a deadly weapon, I got a big laugh out of that. But what's really true is every bite of food that you eat either makes you more alive or it makes you more dead. There really aren't any other choices.